Well, I had a really good time at the Skeptics Forum last week, and you know, we're talking about our missionaries in Pakistan, and one of the special treats for me was meeting the Mitchells. I see we have them right here in class today. Pakistani missionary back home for a little while, and you're heading back to Pakistan fairly soon, I understand, or Middle East area, including Pakistan. So thanks for being with us. But yeah, last week I met three of our missionaries, and that was really fun. So, and Kathy said, my wife, you know, you must have been really excited about those new discoveries, because I just kept going on and on about those new discoveries. So she was encouraging me next time to let you ask a few more questions. So I'll promise to do that. But yeah, I was really charged about all this new stuff that was happening in just the past few days. So forgive my enthusiasm, if you will, and I'll try to allow more time next time. Also, a treat last week was, I don't see Ross here in the class, but he handed me this, which is an ancient volume of Smith's Bible Dictionary. And if you're a fan of Smith's Bible Dictionary, you know that the latest editions have been making a point that the flood most likely is local and not global. But I wasn't aware that Smith himself held that view. So it goes all the way back to the 1850s in the original edition, where Smith made it really clear that, you know, it's got to be this way. And as I've been saying in the class, this idea of a global flood perspective coming out of Genesis is really unique to the 20th century. And so Ross was all excited. He says, hey, I got some evidence that what you're saying is really true. Because if you go back to the 19th century, the predominant view was that the flood was, and by the way, it was interesting how Smith words it. He says it's really clear that the flood is universal, but it's not global. And so evidently, people in the 19th century well understood the difference between universal and global. You know, I've been in, you know, Ross was saying, Hugh, you've been saying this is a 20th century confusion. But it says it's really clear that people even 100 years ago really understood the difference between universal and global. It's really only in the 20th century that we think, well, if it's universal, then it's got to be global. So, anyway, you can read the most ancient editions of Smith's, and it's all there. They haven't changed it in the new editions. So that's really interesting. And by the way, I've been getting a lot of questions in the past couple of weeks about what happened on Mars. And one of the things I really appreciated at the party was hearing from Don in particular why we're seeing these failures on Mars. And Don, if you want to say a few words to the class, I'll give you the mic for a few minutes, because I thought the insights you shared were really on target. And a lot of people in this class have been wondering, what's happening on Mars? What's happening at JPL? And hey, we got a lot of JPL people here. I think it'd be good to hear from the horse's mouth. So you don't mind? Yeah.
Operating with a gag order, which means that people have not been encouraged to talk to the outside press and media in particular, and they're still waiting to talk to the people who were navigating the first one that was lost. But after the first one was lost, I'm not sure what I told you at the party. Do I need a microphone?
Yes.
Oh, you're taping. Okay. For the purpose of the tape, I'll use the microphone. I'm not sure what I told you, Hugh, at the party, but you know. Oh, okay. Well, you could see this in one of the articles just in the popular media in the L.A. Times. They did a comparison how much the Pathfinder cost and then how much they're spending on these later two. And the later two are just cut drastically from even what they spent on the Pathfinder. And I thought it was wonderful that the Pathfinder worked, because there were four things that had to go right in order for it to get down to the surface safely. And they all went right. And none of them could be adequately tested out, because you'd have to take it up in the space shuttle and have it re-enter, and even then it would be a different atmosphere to test that out. So it's not entirely surprising that the polar lander didn't work, because you know at least three things had to go right in order for that to happen, and we'll never really know probably what went wrong with that. With the previous one that they lost, the Mars Observer, at least they were able to implicate some of the piping and say that, well, it's very likely that we had a problem because some of this propellant stuff got in the wrong pipe at a time when it could explode just before the Mars orbit insertion. So they at least had a model, you know, that caused us in my project, which is Cassini, to add a whole bunch of piping and a bunch of these pyro valves and things so that you could pop different things. If one doesn't work, you run a couple of pyros and you go to the next branch in all this piping. It looks like a Rube Goldberg thing. All they added on after that accident. So one of the things that's happening now is JPL is planning on replanning. And I hope and pray that they will add some personnel at crucial points because it's clear that one of the problems with the first one, the climate observer, was that they had part of one guy trying to do the orbit determination. And that's always dangerous. And then if it's a guy who doesn't have a huge amount of operations experience, that's even more dangerous. And they had both of those. But the other thing was that if they'd had better cooperation among the different groups, after all, when you have a small project, you should have a cohesiveness among the people who work on it. And that was one other thing that they cited. The JPL review said that navigation was isolated. And so these guys are taking, you know, I would know. I'm not an orbit determination person, but everybody in navigation knows there's one determination that's difficult, and that's the out-of-plane direction. You're coming in a plane, and your data, which are the one-way or two-way Doppler signal, is very difficult to determine the out-of-plane motion of the spacecraft from that data. And when you're coming into a polar landing, you're coming in over the pole, and the out-of-plane direction goes directly into the altitude. And when you start to see your orbit estimate drift, and you still believe what the Kalman filter tells you about the uncertainty, you're a fool. You shouldn't believe that. And they should have known that, and there were opportunities, at least three of them, to make some other arrangement. See, the horror to me is not quite so much that we lost the polar lander. As Ed Stone himself said, that's the most difficult thing we do is landing on another planet. And the next time, you know, when they want to bring back a sample, that'll be even more difficult because now you've got to take off again and mate up in orbit. The thing that's a really horror is that we lost the first one, which would have been so easy to say.
Get out of Twitter.
Yeah, go ahead. Well, they're in the trunk of my car, but let's see what I can wing off from memory. I think the thing that I made you do that, I know, so I should be able to do that. And I got a whole class here to help me, so that'll work out pretty well. But no, one of the things that I got really excited about is this paper that was published on electron quantum tunneling in proteins and how it showed that the normal means of electron transport that people had thought was going on, namely moving electrons through the OH molecule, really isn't the way it goes. It goes through quantum tunneling. And now the quantum tunneling mechanism is about an order of magnitude more efficient in moving electrons. And so one of the reasons why proteins work as well as they do is they take advantage of quantum tunneling. And how that same quantum tunneling also protects the protein from mutational damage. I mean, all life molecules are exposed to radiation, other factors that will cause their atoms to be redistributed. But by using a quantum tunneling path rather than, you know, a molecular transport path, the protein is much more likely to be preserved in the face of these mutations. And then bottom line is, in order for the protein to work, you have to fine-tune the degree of uncertainty in the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics. And so it's wonderful how physical principles like quantum mechanics and relativity are now being recognized as very carefully designed physical properties that make possible the existence of these complex molecules. I mean, in addition to quantum tunneling, there are certain proteins that only work because of the principle of relativity. And so there's a reason why the velocity of light is 186,000 miles per hour. That's what makes possible the function of these life essential proteins. And the reason, there is a reason why if you measure the energy of a quantum particle accurately, you're not going to know its position any better than plus or minus half a mile. It takes that degree of uncertainty in order for this quantum tunneling to operate at a level that will allow the protein to work. So that was one. We also talked about the fact that they have found 9 new extrasolar planets. So the list went from 20 planets outside of our solar system to 29. And now the evidence is persistent that these planets we're finding outside of our solar system are nothing like the planets inside our solar system. And so before we found these planets, the idea was, well, the universe is going to be filled with planets. There's some good reasons to draw that conclusion. But one thing they're finding is that, one, not all stars have planets. Less than 2% of all the stars have planets. And there's stars that are really young. I mean, what's special about our sun is it's the oldest star that has planets. And, you know, I need a middle-aged solar system for life to be possible. These systems we're looking at, they're young stars and young planets, and in their youth, they're very unstable and not at all suitable for the support of life. We're also finding that these planets have highly eccentric orbits, or these giant planets are orbiting too close to their stars. And both situations guarantee that there's no possibility for life ever around that planetary system. That's two. Let's see. There was a third. I reviewed 6 of them for you last week. So that's 2 of them. Get the tape. All right. That'll work. We talk about chordates. That's it. The Cambrian explosion has now been demonstrated to include not just chordates, but vertebrates. I mean, we talk about the chordate phylum. That's any creature that uses a tube in which to have the nerves go from the brain to the rest of the body. But for a lot of chordates, it's not protected by a backbone. And the most advanced of the chordates are considered to be the vertebrates, like us. Well, they have now found for the first time 2 vertebrate fossils that date right into the Cambrian explosion. And so that underlines that 543 million years ago, we had the sudden appearance of 70 to 100 new phyla. Today we only have 30, and all 30 of the ones we see today were present 543 million years ago. So this old idea you see in your high school textbooks of the fossil tree branching and becoming more and more diverse with more and more branches, the truth of the matter is the Cambrian explosion shows us that it's an upside-down tree. We start with a whole lot of diversity 543 million years ago. We got a lot less today. And it's evolution going the wrong way. So, and I mentioned last week that's been responsible for a number of leading evolutionary biologists coming to faith in Christ. A famous Chinese evolutionary biologist has been converted to the Christian faith through this discovery out of the province of China. So that was 3. We covered 3 more. Trying to remember what those other 3 are, but get the tape, all right? Thank you. So, yes. Yes. But it's not exactly measured. I mean, when scientists say an order of magnitude, that usually means they haven't exactly measured whether it's 12 times faster, 8 times faster, 10 times faster. And so an order of magnitude means it's roughly a factor of 10, give or take 2 or 3. And it may be 2 orders of magnitude. I mean, who knows? This just hasn't been determined. We know it's a whole lot more efficient than moving the electrons from one OH molecule to another. That was not in the paper. That's probably not really a factor. So, the velocity of light factors into those chemical reactions that depend on relativity. So there are certain proteins that encase copper and vanadium, for example. And there the chemical reactions are dependent on the principle of relativity, special relativity. So in that case, the velocity of light is critical. And for quantum tunneling, it's the uncertainty principle. Well, all I said in the paper was an order of magnitude. I can't tell you any more than that. I mean, keep in mind, this is the first experiment demonstrating that quantum tunneling is responsible for this transfer of electrons through the system. So there's only one other paper I know of that deals with the necessity for quantum tunneling in proteins. That was published about 10 years ago. So this one's giving us a lot more detail. Anyway, if you want to see the paper, I think it's in the November 4th or November 4th or 12th issue of Nature. And I got the paper in the trunk of my car if you're really interested. So you can probably see it on their website too. Yeah. No, quantum tunneling goes on everywhere. So when you digest your lunch, quantum tunneling is operating. It's not just in transistors. So it's a principle that takes place. And what we now understand is it must take place for life to be possible. If you want life, you better have quantum mechanics. So, and it's interesting because 15 years ago, quantum mechanics was considered to be the greatest challenge to the Christian faith. We're now realizing is that quantum mechanics is absolutely essential for life to be possible. More than that, quantum mechanics must be very precisely fine-tuned. The reason why a lot of theologians thought quantum mechanics was such a great threat is because back in the early 1980s, there was a lot of speculation that hidden in the uncertainty may be some human causality. And there were people speculating along the lines of Niels Bohr. Maybe I should back up a little bit. The father of modern quantum mechanics is considered to be the Danish physicist Niels Bohr. But a lot of people don't realize is Niels Bohr was a Hindu. And so he was impressing his Hindu theology upon the principles of quantum mechanics. And so if you took physics in high school or college, you probably heard something called the Copenhagen School of Interpretation. And that's where Niels Bohr lived, was in Copenhagen. And he was the one that developed this interpretation. It's still the most common interpretation of quantum mechanics, although it's quite now evident that it's wrong interpretation. And that's this idea that because the uncertainty principle hides our capacity to observe in detail the cause and effect relationships going on in quantum mechanics, he speculated that it's the human observer that actually generates the causality. Therefore, we human beings are the creators rather than God being the creator. That's kind of the reasoning that's going on in there. And this is why so many theologians in the 1980s and Christian seminaries were saying this is the greatest threat to the Christian faith, because it looked like it was taking God off the throne and putting man on the throne. The most extreme version of that I saw in the early 1990s was the idea that the universe creates us, but because we're making observations, we create the universe. And if you think about it, it's a total violation of the principles of quantum mechanics, because what it's really saying is we human observers can influence the past. By our powers of observation today, we can influence what took place 15 billion years ago when the universe was created. It's also, of course, assuming that the universe was created through quantum mechanics, and we now know that's impossible. So that's why people perceive this to be such a great threat. I think what's really wonderful is we're now understanding that when Albert Einstein said God does not play dice, and you know, I think that's one reason why a lot of these Hindu ideas got going. They said, well, the heart of Christianity is determinism. God does not play dice. In quantum mechanics, we see that dice indeed is being thrown. Therefore, God does not exist. The Christian God does not exist. A lot of that reasoning was going on. In fact, Niels Bohr himself would espouse those kinds of arguments encountering Albert Einstein. And that's really why Albert Einstein was opposed to quantum mechanics. He saw it as a concept that took God off the throne. He was not a Christian. he wasn't even a Jewish theist, but he was certainly opposed to the idea that there was no God. And he saw in quantum mechanics a challenge to that concept. So I think the battle between Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein is responsible for this idea that it's such a huge threat, because everybody today knows Albert Einstein lost the battle. Niels Bohr was proven right. Quantum mechanics is reality. Albert Einstein was proven wrong. And what we now understand is God does play dice, but he very carefully designs the dice to do what he desires. And if God doesn't throw the dice of quantum mechanics, then advanced life forms won't exist. Well, when you see a quantum event take place, it could manifest itself as a wave phenomena or as a particle phenomena. You know, when I took freshman physics, what the professor would teach us was, well, on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, we're going to teach that light is waves in nature, and on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and yes, we had Saturday classes, they're going to teach that light is particular in nature. And that's what I mean by throwing dice. Before the quantum event takes place, you don't know whether it's going to manifest itself as a wave or as a particle. And where Niels Bohr thought the human observer was responsible, if we choose to set up the quantum experiment to select for waves, that's what we're going to see. If we choose it to pick out the particles, that's what we're going to see. And so people got the idea that we're influencing the outcome. And it's just a matter of throwing the dice in that sense. Yes. Now, God did not use quantum physics to create the universe. Now, here's how you can easily prove that. One of the principles of quantum mechanics is that you can get this quantum tunneling phenomena to take place. The probability of the quantum tunneling occurring goes up with the time interval. The more time, the more certainty you have that this quantum tunneling is going to occur for this particle. The reason you cannot apply quantum mechanics to the creation of the universe, we know from the space-time theorem of general relativity, at the creation of the universe, the time interval is zero. Since the time interval is zero, the probability for any quantum event to take place is also zero. Which is why those astrophysicists who are trying to say God did not create the universe must appeal to a breakdown in the laws of physics. So what they're claiming is, well, the laws of physics don't hold all the way back to t equals zero. Just before t equals zero, there's a complete breakdown in the laws of physics, and therefore we don't have to listen to the principles of quantum mechanics, or gravity, or relativity, or string theory. When did quantum mechanics come into play? The 1920s. I mean, when did the phenomena... The Roaring Twenties. Oh, no. Quantum mechanics becomes important in the history of the universe once you get past t equals zero. So, for example, in the first 10 to the minus 40 seconds, quantum mechanics is important. In the first 10 to the minus 50 seconds, quantum mechanics is important. But right at t equals zero, no. And see, all these theories about trying to create the universe without God are saying that at t equals zero, a quantum fluctuation spawned the universe into existence. Well, one thing we know from general relativity is that the creation event, there is no time. Time does not yet exist, and therefore the possibility of quantum events is not possible. Once you've got time in existence, then quantum mechanics becomes important. That we now know that quantum mechanics must operate in that very early era of the universe, or we're not going to get the particles to operate the way they did. And by the way, one way to slam the door in all this, string theory, which you've been hearing so much about on PBS and even in the comics, as I heard this morning, made the comic strips, that tells us that the laws of physics are valid all the way back to T equals zero. The reason why there is speculation about the laws of physics breaking down is because before string theory came along, we knew there was no way to reconcile quantum mechanics and gravity. All of our theories of gravity proved that quantum mechanics was false. All of our theories of quantum mechanics proved that gravity was false. And therefore, some physicists were speculating, therefore, there must be different physical laws where it's important for quantum mechanics and gravity to coexist. And that era is before 10 to the minus 34 seconds. It's absolutely essential they coexist during that era. And I said, since we know that they don't, therefore, there must be different laws of physics. But what string theory has done for us is shown us that quantum mechanics and gravity can coexist all the way back to T equals zero without any problem at all, as long as we recognize that the universe is created with 10 space-time dimensions instead of 4. There simply isn't enough room within length, width, height, and time for all the symmetries demanded by both quantum mechanics and gravity. But we have very strong evidence now that the universe indeed is 10-dimensional. If it's 10-dimensional, the laws of physics are valid back to T equals zero, which means there's no escaping the God of the Bible. So there's your quick physics proof for the God of the Bible. Yes? It is. In fact, Don Gray and I were discussing before the class, you know, isn't it incredible that string theory is making the comics? And, you know, I was saying, well, I think the reason why it's hitting the comics is because of Brian Greene's Elegant Universe. This theory has been well established now for a couple of years, and yet it really hasn't settled into the genre of the lay public. Why? Because up until Brian Greene's book, all books written on string theory were utterly incomprehensible to the layman. So Green needs to be commended. And by the way, I wanted to do it for the Beyond the Cosmos, but the publisher said, you've got to get it down into one chapter. So my five chapter had to be squished down into, it's the longest chapter in the book, so I managed to get a little bit in that way, but I was forced to condense it down to about 30 pages. Yes. By the way, you can pick up your book afterwards. I was discussing this before you arrived. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, one of the reasons we know that the young Earth proposition that says, well, the velocity of light changed. By the way, you all know why they say that? Light travel time. The stars and galaxies are so far away that if the velocity of light indeed is constant throughout the entire history of the universe, then obviously it takes billions of years for that light to reach us here on Earth, and it can't be a young universe. And so to get around that, they say, well, the velocity of light was nearly infinite in the days of Adam and Eve and has decayed from that very high value down to 186,000 miles per second. But as Ross points out, if you really believe that, then none of us would be here. Because if the velocity of light was any different for Adam than it was for us, his proteins wouldn't work, and he would die. So, and by the way, there's lots of other excellent reasons why. Well, I'll give you one. Astronomers measure the velocity of light every time they look at a star or a galaxy. And so when we look at the star Betelgeuse, we're measuring the velocity of light 300 years ago. That's how long it took the light to reach it. It's the same as what we measure right now. We can look at the Crab Nebula, 7,000 light years away, and the velocity of light in the Crab Nebula is identical to what we measure today. Likewise, for galaxies as distant as 12 billion light years, it's identical. And finally, if you make C a little bit bigger, look what you do to relativity. And incidentally, I have found that there's one equation every layman knows, E equals MC squared. Well, one physicist friend of mine says that's probably true for 90% of the population, that's the only equation that they know. but C is the velocity of light. So if you make C any bigger, look what you do to the energy term. And one reason we know the velocity of light wasn't any different for Adam than it was for us, he would have been incinerated by the heat of the sun if the velocity of light were any bigger. So you can work it out in the equation. Take that home with you. Hey, let's get on to what we were supposed to discuss today, all right? And we've been reviewing this evidence out of Genesis. Why the flood is universal but not global. Thank you, Tom, for focusing that up for us. And we've been going through these 17 different arguments why the flood, though universal, cannot possibly be global, based on what we see in the text. And so one of the arguments we used was the many verses in the Bible that makes the point that the entire face of the earth or all the peoples of the earth doesn't necessarily translate into the entire globe. You know, such claims that all the kings of the earth came to visit Solomon to hear of his wisdom, kings from as far away as the queen of Ethiopia, and that's really not that far away, but that was the whole world in the context of King Solomon. Likewise in Rome, where it says the faith of the Romans has been heard throughout the entire world. The entire world for the Romans was the extent of the Roman Empire. Number two, the limited extent of sin. God will only judge for his judgment wrath where sin exists, where reprobation exists. And we know that human sin had not yet visited Antarctica, for example. No people had ever lived there. And therefore, there would be no need for God to flood Antarctica, and there would be no need for God to kill off all the emperor penguins, since the emperor penguins would have had no contact with these human sinners. Number three is a limited water supply. There simply isn't enough water in the resources of the earth to supply a global flood. The text tells us the water came from the earth, underground aquifers and the rain clouds, and Genesis chapter 8 tells us that it returned to those same sources. And the appeal to tectonics and erosion to make for a much flatter earth really doesn't work. You have to appeal to so much tectonics and erosion that there be no possibility for the ark to survive. In fact, we made the point that if you're really going to jam in all that tectonics, there's not even the possibility for fragments of your fingernails to survive. So it's not just a matter of the ark being smashed. You really wouldn't find any pieces of the human beings that were on board the ark, given the energy released from the huge amount of tectonics. And number five, the Bible texts make it really clear that the human race had failed to fulfill God's command to fill the earth. Remember, multiply and fill the earth, Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 9, the command is repeated to Noah and his descendants in much sharper language. And what we see in Genesis chapter 11, we'll be studying that next, is that the command to fill the earth was embedded in God's intent to set up the human species in such a way that sin could be restrained. Remaining in one place was a surefire formula for multiplying the sin. Scattering ourselves over the face of the earth is one way to restrain the expression of sin. And so the fact that we have God condemning humanity twice for their failure to fill the earth is a good indication that people in days before the flood indeed had not filled the earth. The lower animals are excluded. We notice in the Genesis chapters, remember that day we went through the four chapters of Genesis and we hit all the different words in the Hebrew for the animals, and we recognize in looking up the lexical definitions, there's nothing in the lexical definitions of the words used for animals that would suggest anything more than birds and mammals. And so what we have are the floodwaters targeting the birds and mammals that are related or associated or had some kind of contact with human beings. And so Adam, for example, is not instructed to take all the reptiles and amphibians on board the ark. He could leave them off the ark. He was not instructed to save a 500,000 species of beetles. And therefore, there is no basis for the atheist charge that the ark would have been too crowded, and it would have been impossible for Noah and his sons and daughters-in-laws to have cleaned up all after all the animals on board the ark. we're talking probably no more than 4,000 pairs of animals on board the ark, birds and mammals. And, of course, there's a spiritual principle for this. Only birds and mammals can be negatively impacted by human sin. You've probably all noticed that already, that your sin definitely does have an impact on the birds and mammals that live around you, but it doesn't do anything to the insects that live around you. The mosquitoes seem to behave the way they behave, regardless of how much people sin in front of them. But it's really different for the horses, the dogs, and the cats. And number seven, there are no geographical place names beyond Greater Mesopotamia. In fact, we counted that there are only seven geographical place names total mentioned in the first nine chapters of Genesis. And all of those geographical place names are connected with the region of Mesopotamia. But guess what happens when you hit Genesis chapter 10? Geography now becomes global. So Genesis 1 through 9, local geography. Genesis chapter 10, global geography. And then we looked at the two passages that are most frequently quoted to prove a global flood. Genesis 7:19, where it talks about the waters covering the whole face of the earth. And we noted that and covering all the highest mountains. I have one English translation, but we expose you to some other English translations. What did the other English translations say? The waters covered the hills. Some said they covered the high hills, some the elevated hills, and one unfortunate translation, all the highest mountains. And what we realized is there's only this word har in the Hebrew. Gaboah har is what's translated the highest mountains. But that word har could mean hill, mountain, peak. It could mean the mound in your backyard. And the word Gaboah means that this mound, hill, or peak is elevated above the geography in its region. So we're talking about geographic relief that is elevated above the plain. And these were what was covered with the waters of the flood. And we showed you a map of Mesopotamia and how Mesopotamia is ringed by hills and mountains all the way around. So it's basically some kind of a trough. You've got hills and mountains literally all the way around the Mesopotamian floodplain. But we also showed you just how big this plain is. This is not the San Joaquin Valley. It's about as long as the San Joaquin Valley, but it's much wider. And yet those of you who have driven up Highway 99 realize that you can't see the high mountains on both sides. I mean, there's the high Sierras on one side, the Coast Range on another. One range is 5,000 feet high. The other range is 14,000 feet high. But if you're driving up Highway 99, at least for a good section of it, you can't see anything except flat land on both sides. Well, with Mesopotamia, you've got a valley that's four or five times broader. And so it'd be quite easy for Noah to be floating in the ark for a whole year and never see any hills or mountains, even if the water is only 300 feet deep. From his perspective, he would not be able to see the hills or the mountains. Yes. Okay, God could have told Noah to move. Okay, question to all of you. Why did God not tell Noah to pick up his family and his belongings and move out of Mesopotamia, and he would destroy all of humanity that was living there except for him? That was one option. Instead, he told him to build an ark. Why did God not say to Noah and his family, move out? I'm going to wipe these people out. After all, that's what he did with Lot, right? Lot, he said, move. I'm going to destroy these people. You move first. God could have done the same thing to Noah. Why did he tell Lot to move and not tell Noah to move? Okay? Sure. Okay, very good. This is not the only passage in the Bible that talks about Noah and the flood. You can go to the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, and read about Noah and the flood. You can read Peter's letters, and he speaks about the flood. What you get from the New Testament passages is that God raised up Noah to be a prophet to his generation. And you've heard me make the comment here that whenever God brings about judgment, wrath, he always sends a prophet to those people that are about to be judged, and he always gives that prophet a pulpit. Now, in Noah's case, the pulpit was this aircraft carrier-sized boat being built in a place where it never rained. Okay, that got people's attention. And he probably had 1,000 or so people working with him to build this thing. And I don't think he was involved in the building, because based on what Peter says, Noah did not spend those 100 years building the ark. He spent those 100 years preaching to that wicked generation. He let his sons and everybody else build the ark. He was there to preach. And, you know, people came to hear this fellow and to see this huge boat being built in the desert. In the case of Lot, what was his pulpit? He had one too, but it was a different one. Pardon me? The gates of the city. He was made a judge by the people of Sodom and the gates of the city of Sodom. And so in that sense, we had Lot for many years preaching to that wicked generation. And again, the New Testament brings that out. I mean, you can read Genesis 18 and 19, but look at the New Testament. It speaks about, in Hebrews, how God had raised up Lot as a judge in the city gate of Sodom to preach to that generation before God brought out his wrath. And so in the case of Lot, he says, well, you've already given the message, leave. I'm going to destroy these people. And in the case of Noah, he said, build this boat, and I'm going to use that to get the attention of the people so that you can preach to them. Yeah. That's right. And see, what God is doing is proving to you and to me that the judgment wrath he poured out was justified. Because it was in 100 years, not one convert. Now, I think the ark was oversized. I mean, you can figure it out. 4,000 pairs of animals maximum. It could have been as low as 800 or 900 pairs of animals. And yet this thing is 450 feet long, you know, 75 feet wide. I think what happened was God told Noah, build the boat extra big. So not only can you take on board all these animals and your family, you can offer passage to anyone who repents. And so the ark was a message of hope to those people. You can deliver yourself from the coming judgment. Join me on board the ark. We've got lots of room. We got lots of supplies and food. We can ride this thing out. And yet everybody turned them down. And, you know, the same thing happened in Sodom, remember? The offer was made. And even the sons-in-laws of Lot's daughters turned him down. He said, we're not going to go with you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I think there were 8 believers on board the ark. It could have been. I mean, we really don't know what the spiritual state of the other 7 were, for that matter. Noah certainly was called a righteous man before he started building the ark. And, yeah, after you hear your dad preach for 100 years, that might get through to you. Some of us wonder that's what it's going to take with our kids, right? Okay, we discussed that, what, maybe 8 months ago, how many people there were at the time of the flood. Any of you remember our discussion? What were the approximate numbers of people on the face of the earth at the time of the building of ark? Oh, she's looking back in her notes. So she's going to be able to give us the answer soon. Okay. What we talked about 8 months ago, it wasn't that long ago, it was like 4 months ago, I guess. We talked about how the potential was there for Noah to be surrounded by 16 billion people. The population of the earth could have easily exceeded our current human population. Except for one factor. What was that one factor? Murder. Murder is what kept the human population down. And by the way, why can we confidently state that it would have been no big deal for there to be, say, 10 billion people on the face of the earth? Because they lived about 1,000 years apiece. So if people weren't being killed off, you've got couples being reproductive for, say, 600 years. And your best birth control method is the rhythm method without the benefit of thermometers, then you're looking at least 100,000 daughters besides those three sons that they gave birth to. And with 150 children minimum per couple, what we discover is that if murder wasn't a restraining factor, there would have been 17 billion people on the face of the earth by the time Adam was 760 years old. So even in Adam's lifetime, that's what I find interesting about Genesis 1. When God told Adam and Eve to multiply and fill the earth, they had the capacity to fulfill that command in their own lifetime. This wasn't something off in the distant future. They themselves could have made that happen. Reason didn't happen, Genesis chapter 4. Cain introduced the sin of murder, and as that chapter points out, murder quickly multiplied in terms of its expression. It also explains why God spoke so sharply to Noah in the ninth chapter. You know, the flood is over, and God takes Noah aside and says, from now on, murder must be restrained. And this is the first institution of the death penalty in the Bible. And basically what God is saying to Noah, I'm not going to tolerate this murder any longer. It must be stopped. And if you need the death penalty to bring it under control, do it. Because I'm not going to have this murder unchecked like it was in the days before the flood. Now then, remember we did a little calculation here in the class to explain why, if the reason where we come up with a few million, we have zero archaeological evidence for the peoples in the days before the flood. None. Now to explain the total lack of archaeological evidence, the human population at that time must have been relatively low. I mean, if there were a billion people, there's no way there wouldn't be archaeological evidence. And so it had to be a lot less than a billion to explain the lack of evidence. In fact, we have good reason that Mesopotamia was not as completely populated as it was in the days of Babylon and the Babylonian Empire or the Assyrian Empire or even today. It had to be less than that. So at most a few million, maybe more likely a few hundred thousand people. Now, to explain the human population being that low with the capacity for human reproduction being so extremely high, remember we calculated exactly what the murder rate must have been? Yeah, about 19 out of 20 people or more were dying a death of murder. So not very many people were making it to age 900. That's how long you would live if you didn't get killed off by somebody. No gun control. No arrow control, no knife control, no sin control. That's really what it's down to, no sin control. So with 19 out of 20 people dying a death of murder, then we get an appreciation why God acted the way he did. I mean, he had to intervene with this kind of a measure, otherwise human race would have self-exterminated. That's what we see in Genesis chapter 6. Things were so bad in terms of human morality that the human species was in danger of rapid extinction, self-extinction. God intervenes to save the human species from being extinguished by their own sin. So that's this whole story that unfolds. And it just makes you wonder, can you imagine society today if 19 out of 20 people were dying a death of murder? And what would it be like? What was it like for Noah to preach in a generation where, you know, the prophets were being killed off at that rate? You know, God told him, you're going to preach for 100 years. He's looking around him at the murder rate and just saying, you know, how's this going to be? That's one reason why a lot of Bible scholars believe that Noah was a powerful prince. He must have been very powerful and very rich in order for he and his family to be protected throughout those 100 years from being slaughtered or murdered. Okay, there was a comment over here. Yeah, great. Yeah, I'm arguing that that is post-flood evidence. Well, remember we went through, did we go through that exercise? I thought we did, where we dated the flood. through the latest scientific measures on the Vela supernova. I think we covered that. Yeah. And if not, you'll find it in the Genesis question. Sorry. I didn't mean to damage your book, Ross. But, we now have some measures out of Germany and Britain that the Vela supernova eruption took place 20 to 30,000 years ago. That's roughly consistent with the oldest cave art we see in Spain and France. And we're still trying to figure out how well dated those are. They say 32,000 years, but it might be a little bit less. We don't know. The land bridges that permitted human migration, we haven't talked about that yet. We will when we get to Genesis chapter 11. Those land bridges that permitted human migration out of Europe and Asia into all the parts of the earth weren't formed. The earliest of those were formed 30,000 years ago. The latest of those formed only 14,000 years ago. And so that would mean that the flood would be previous to that time. No, they don't try to attribute. The earliest Neanderthal we got is about 38,000 years ago. And there was a recent flap out of Spain that they found this child skeleton that they thought was a hybrid between a human being and a Neanderthal. That's been discredited. So, and as we mentioned in the Genesis question, there is strong mitochondrial DNA evidence that establishes that Neanderthals made no contribution to the human gene pool. Their mitochondrial DNA is just too different from ours for that to be a possibility. So, yeah, we have no evidence that Neanderthals ever practiced art or music. There was a big flap a year ago that they had found this Neanderthal flute, and they now realize that those holes in that leg bone were caused by an animal, not by a Neanderthal. And they only had two holes anyway, so... as a two-note flute, right? Well, they're claiming it was a portion of a flute. But no, for about 2 years, this was considered to be crucial evidence that Neanderthals indeed were highly musical people. And incidentally, I was not personally threatened by that evidence because music to me is something that flows out of the soul and not the spirit. Not that I'm trying to differentiate between the human soul and the spirit, but what you see in Genesis 1 is God made physical animals, soulish animals, and spirit animals. And we are body, soul, and spirit. We're the only species that God ever made that's body, soul, and spirit. But he made lots of animals that are endowed with mind, will, and emotions, birds and mammals. And hey, we're not the only species that practices music and enjoys music. There are not very many mammals that do that, but lots of birds do. And I think I told you a story once about this pet parrot I had that was a music critic. My sister's music, he just hated, and he would make a terrible squawk whenever they tried to play their records. But all he had to do is, his favorite was Bach. And he put Bach on, and he was really swaying to the music and chirping very, it was really cute. He liked, Bach was his favorite. His next favorite was, not Mozart. Mozart was his third. Anyways. Another German, Beethoven. He liked Beethoven. Yeah. Yeah. Especially Beethoven's ninth. I mean, it was really wonderful to have this bird that was a music critic. But our dogs and cats never got into it. They didn't care what we played. Whilst it wasn't too loud. But the parrot was different. So, did I answer your question adequately? Okay, fine. Yes. Supernova, right. Yeah, that's what you'll see in the Genesis question, is that the Vela supernova eruption changes the radiation environment for the human species. So before the Vela supernova eruption, you got much less cosmic radiation than you have today. It was 2 years ago a couple of Russian astronomers established that the vast majority of killer cosmic rays come from that one supernova event. Now, before that, astronomers thought they came from hundreds of supernova. Now we know they come from just one. and that one dates 20 to 30,000 years ago. And so that means you would have the possibility of people living with a lot less radiation in the days before the flood than after the flood. Now, I'll be the first to tell you, the Bible doesn't tell you how God shortened human lifespans. It just says he did do it. And I'm simply making a point that we have a radiation event that would indicate that there'd be a possibility for God setting up the biochemistry of our bodies so that we could live longer in the days before the flood than after. You got to do something about the radiation, that's clear. But it's really should be labeled as speculation because the text doesn't specify. It just says that God did it. But if that was the method he used or one of the methods he used, then that gives us the date of 20 to 30,000 years ago. And it is interesting that that's consistent with the dates for when the land bridges formed and broke to permit human migration out of Mesopotamia. We'll be hitting that when we hit Genesis chapter 11. Hey, moving on. Boy, we're really cutting through this, aren't we? But, you know, we had some good diversions in this class. So, Genesis 8:4, text does not say Mount Ararat, does it? It says the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat, and we all know that word for mountains is that word Har. It could be the hills of Ararat. And our little map shows that these mountains and hills of Ararat encompass about 150,000 square miles, literally coming right down to the plain of Mesopotamia. So just north of the city of Nineveh, you've got the mountains of Ararat. And let's make this point. The ark is too fragile for a flood that's made global in just 40 days. I mean, you can figure that out. Put one of your little pets in your swimming pool and get all the water in there in 3 seconds, and you're going to have problems pulling that little mouse out of the water alive, all right? Or put a little one of your son's little balsa wood boats in your pool and fill it up in 3 seconds and see what happens to his little balsa wood boat. I mean, you can work out these things. So that's the problem. If you're going to make it global in just 40 days, nothing's going to survive. And this is what I really wanted to get to. This is the new stuff, which we're probably going to have to get to next week. So, huh? All right. But we'll cover these three next week because they go together. A global flood cannot recede in just 11 months because, as we noticed, the text tells us that in 335 days, the flood goes from this universal condition where it's at its fullness and where it's completely dried up, where the ground is completely dry. That happens in just 335 days. And we're going to point out with a global flood, there's no way you can dry up the ground that fast. It's not going to happen. In fact, we're going to calculate how much time you're going to need, and it's a lot of time. And we also note that the text makes the point that the water was removed through a strong wind. And that's a good way to remove a flood that covers Mesopotamia, say, 300, 400, 500 feet deep. It's going to take a pretty strong wind and a very dry wind to do that. But living here in Southern California, I think we've got the basis to calculate this. How quickly can you evaporate water in a very dry Santa Ana wind blowing 50 miles per hour? What you discover is you can remove a lot of water in a brief period of time. But you're not going to remove 10,000 feet of water. So I think that's probably a good way to do it. Let's look at an extremely dry, very hard-blowing Santa Ana wind and see what that does, and then recognize what kind of limits that places on the extent of the flood. Yes. Yeah, if the entire planet is filled with water, where are you going to get this dry wind? That's a good point. Thank you. We'll have you give a little lecture on that for us next week, okay? Yes, great. Yes. That's true. Yeah. If you're at high altitude, you can get it to dry a little faster. But then we'll talk about the olive leaves. I think that's one of the interesting things. Olive leaves survive the flood. So it's got to be a reasonably tranquil condition to allow olive leaves to make it through the flood. Okay. And we got a whole bunch more here we'll cover. We're going to get through this. All right? There we go. If you want the whole list of, well, I got 18 here. I thought I only had 17, but they're 18. We keep adding to this. Well, our time's up. We'll get back to this next week. And I'm not going to talk about all these exciting scientific discoveries. We'll kind of jump right into this and make some headway here. Okay, let's go. Father in heaven, thank you for this time we've had in a variety of subjects this morning. And Lord, I pray we'd walk away with this and you would bless us with opportunities to meet people in the course of these next few days that need evidences to believe in you, to believe in the reliability of the Bible. And Father, may you bring this material and other material we've learned here to mind that we can be used as an effective witness to let your light penetrate the hearts of our friends and associates and bear fruit with your love, life, and truth. In Jesus' name, amen.